Hey, maybe while you're there looking at that song we linked up at the website, coasttocoastam.com, earlier, this song called R.E. Your Brains, about office zombies. And if you missed it, you ought to go back and listen in Coast Insider to last week's zombie show. Well-reviewed. Thank you, everybody, for the kind comments. I enjoyed that, too, quite a bit, and I look forward to having that author on again in the future, much like having David Elkington back when this more of the information of what's in the book can be revealed, the books, the 70 metal codices, which we've been talking about for the last hour or so on Coast to Coast. You go to coasttocoastam.com, link up to that story, take a look at the photos of these small to medium-sized metal books, and you can see some of the images that are in there. We were talking about some of the information that's also in there, written in a proto-Hebraic language, which is referred to as kind of a Hasmonean dialect. David Elkington was just telling us about some of the things that they're figuring out as they decode this information that's in these books. We'll find out more about that in just a second. And then also got to ask him about the timing of all of this. Does he find it interesting that comes right about at a time when some people are saying the world is about to end? Could these be the books that are to be unsealed according to the book of Revelation next on Coast to Coast? This is Ian Bonnet. All right, David Elkington, scholar, author, and artist who was given access to these codices. By the way, why do you think you're in a select group of people who have seen them? What, I mean, other than you're writing a book and you have a personal relationship, how come these haven't ended up, say, over at Oxford or Cambridge or, you know, Princeton Theological Seminary or something like that?
Well, again, you know, you get a series of sealed books mentioned in the book of Revelation. And as soon as I saw that they were sealed, I thought we've got to be very careful here because you don't want to create a sense of panic in people in terms of expectation and what they may well contain, etc. You've got to play it very, very carefully. And so we decided that actually, because it's a very unique find, the best thing would be to get together the best academic team we could from across the world. And that's exactly what we've done. We have an American, we have a couple of British people involved. There will be a bunch of Jordanian scholars who will actually be looking at the epigraphy or the decipherment of the text and so on and so forth. We want to make sure that we've got the best and open minds on this so that we can actually create a bigger debate and stimulate a wider debate about the origins of Christianity in the light of these things being deciphered and more information about them coming out.
Interesting. So since you mentioned the book of Revelation, I'll go back to that. This connection of the sealed books, you know, here you have, by some people's estimation, a second coming on May 21st, which is something that George is going to talk more about tomorrow night on Coast to Coast. You have the 2012 prophecy. You have some people who are millennial-minded again, right? Thinking apocalyptically about the times we're in, looking at the tsunami and the earthquake and the meltdown in Japan. Do you see a connection in these books and these recent events?
It is quite curious how, since we've opened some of the sealed books, that there have been meltdowns, earthquakes, and Arab uprisings in the Middle East. I must admit, I mean, the thought has occurred to me in a very amused way, that as a biblical scholar, of course, my understanding of the word apocalypse is different from that of a lot of people, because if you look at the word apocalypse in its original Greek form, all it means is revelation or that which is revealed from out of the hidden. And I think that the great blessing for myself and Jennifer in being the ones who have been in the position to actually see these things and to do something about it has been that we believe that we stand at a point in history where new things will now be revealed to humankind about who we are and where we are. And if you look at the state of the world now, people are looking for something. They're looking for that something special that seems to have been missing over the past 20, 30 years or so. Our world is very materialistic. We are very obsessed, and particularly in my country, with celebrity and things that don't last very long. And I think people are looking for a great deal of more meaning in their lives. And so it is really, really interesting that these books have cropped up at precisely the right moment.
Yeah, we never have that here in this country. We never really talk about celebrities much, and we're much more focused on deeper, philosophical, profound issues.
I'm really glad to hear that. I think that's quite wonderful.
Complete lie. All right. So, but now, so these, even the leather that was binding some of these books. Now, you've tested the leather?
No, I haven't actually.
Okay.
What I've done is I have got two strips of leather from one of the books, but we have yet to get that carbonated. We've had a lot of opposition in terms of trying to prevent us from getting this into the general public sphere, because, of course, there's an opposition out there that wants to sell these into the black market. But fortunately now we're working with the Jordanian government to repatriate these things. And the Jordanians have been quite wonderful in terms of their cooperation and their support for this project. And of course, you know, let's not forget, this is Jordanian property. It does belong to them. But the leather, we hope in about the next few weeks or so, we'll find a good laboratory and we will get it carbon tested.
Because that can be because it's leather it once lived. Right.
Exactly. And you know what's exciting about that? It's really quite remarkable. You can actually, look at it on a microscopic DNA basis, and you can virtually tell the species of sheep that it came from and almost the very field that it came from. But that's pretty remarkable stuff.
Yeah, it sure is. Now, when you speak so definitively, these 70 codices, which are still, as I understand it, currently held by an Israeli Bedouin, yes?
Exactly, yes, over in Israel,
okay.
in northern Israel, yeah.
The same guy who's shown them to you, or at least been responsible for you being able to see them, you believe he shouldn't have them?
I've got to be very fair here and say that when we first started discussing this with the Bedouin concerned, we said to him, look, this is a very, very important find, and they should be in a museum. And he was very, very agreeable to that. And, you know, he's been a very good guardian of these things. He's looked after them very, very well. But unfortunately, there are other forces out there who have seen monetary gain from this and who want to make a profit from them. And we've been battling against them now for almost 4 years, because my wife and I feel very blessed that we've come into contact with this discovery and understand and appreciate, probably more than anybody else at the moment, truly the significance of the find and what they are. We really didn't sort of understand quite how significant until the director of Jordanian Antiquities, Dr. Al-Saad, stated earlier this week that this could possibly be the most important archaeological find in history, which is really quite something.
It sure is.
You know, and so we're trying our best to persuade the Bedouin that there would be a great deal of honor in it for him to repatriate them to Jordan and to be associated with this quite extraordinary find.
But can't both goals be achieved? I mean, can't there be some sort of lump sum payment given to these Bedouins that make this profitable and at the same time guarantee that they won't end up on some black market in private collections, you know, going to someplace maybe even where they might be destroyed, depending on some zealot's point of view, and making sure they go into the proper, you know, historical museum or academic setting at the same time?
Ian, I've got to agree with you there wholeheartedly. This is a moral question now, and it would be an irony that one of history's greatest people, the man who many people hold to be the Son of God, should have his work dealt with by criminals and crooks. I think it would be terrible. It would be an awful irony if his works were subjected to these terrible things. And it is a moral point. I think the Bedouin who has looked after these things should be recompensed. And yes, he should see them in a museum to which he should have access. I couldn't agree with you more.
It would seem like a fairly easy thing to work out. It really doesn't seem that hard. I mean, the only complication is highest bidder. And if by going to the black market, then you amp the profit motive up to the point of trying to create a bidding war for them. That's just greed. But I mean, if we can move it back a little bit and say he deserves X number of dollars for every authentic book, well, then everybody wins.
Indeed, they do. But at the moment, the real question is, how do we raise the money and how do we go about doing it? Because, as you know, the world is in severe financial crisis at the moment, and there isn't much money around.
How much do you think it's worth?
Oh, crikey. You know, this collection is beyond value for me personally.
Right.
But in terms, in realistic terms for what the Bedouin should expect, I mean, that would have to be between any donor and the Jordanian government and Hassan, the Bedouin concerned. The Jordanian government is also, you know, very keen to see these things repatriated, of course, and will do anything it can to help the Bedouin concerned to cooperate and to be recompensed for his time and for his efforts.
Yeah, do we think 10 million might, you know, grease the wheels here a little bit?
I think it would, definitely. If we could find that kind of money, I think it would probably help to resolve the situation very quickly. And, hey, you know, it might lead to wonderful things happening with these things finally being in the hands of the Jordanian scholars, where they could go into a museum, we could decipher them, and everybody could go and see them. I think it would be winners all around.
I would think there would be a few, you know, oil-rich Jordanians or somebody somewhere who would be of Jordanian descent that would have an extra $10 million lying around that would be willing to do that in order to repatriate them.
Well, you know, this
doesn't seem like that much money.
Yeah, this is a find which is important for all humanity. You know, not the Jordanians also realize that too. They've been very, very clever and very compassionate in that way. And, you know, they want to be seen as a multicultural country, which they are. And they want Christians from all over the world to come and see these things, and Jews and Muslims too, because all these religions are affected by these codices.
Sure.
And I think that, the great thing is that these codices finally are going to have all three religions talking to each other under terms of great friendship, because it's going to lead to profound understanding. And I think that this is what makes this discovery so exciting.
Well, I think everything about this is exciting. The faster we can get the information from these books and get access to them so that we can all experience them together, the better. I only am in by rich Jordanians. It's a nice way to win one for the home team, you know. It's just...
I agree.
Yeah, it would be
great if somebody could come up with something like that. Or again, you know, we through cooperation through American and British help and European help, perhaps.
Yeah.
You know, make it a multinational approach that everybody can join in, because, as I say, this is for everybody. And I think that from what I've seen and from the photographs I've got and from we're going to release some more information in a few weeks' time, which you will find quite stunning. It is quite, quite stunning. And when you see it, you're going to think to yourself, goodness me. And then you'll understand why I've said that everybody of all nationalities should join in this, because what we have here, I think, is the second coming of Christ. And it is time for the world to actually wake up to the fact that we're going to go through great change, but I think very, very positive change at that.
I'm fascinated by that. And I would love to be able to have you back on again when we get close to that date. That's if you say a few weeks' time, that is getting perilously close to May 21st. And this prediction that's been out for a while about the second coming of Christ, it seems like it times out almost perfectly.
Well, you know, I was unaware of that. I'm just a biblical scholar who spends most of his day with his nose in books, which are full of very long words and very, very good scholarship. And I don't listen to any of these things. But if that's the way it's going to be, then obviously there's something else working behind me and my wife and guiding us in this. And for that, we're thankful.
Fascinating. If you want to go online, coasttocoastam.com, take a look at these metal books, these codices. It's a very unusual framework. There are codices from millennia ago, but they're rare, and usually they are vellum, right? Are there often metal codices? Usually they're leather bound.
Leather bound, parchment or papyrus.
Yeah, papyrus. Yeah.
To see them in lead is just this is just totally unique. And when I first saw the Discovery, I thought in terms of McDonald's. You know, I thought, gosh, this is a supersized me. This is the Discovery of all. You know,
Ray Kroc would love that. All right, so what we'll do is a little bit later on this hour. We'll take some phone calls for you, and then we'll do open lines for the rest of this hour. But David Elkington, kind enough to give us another half hour to take some calls and answer some of your questions about what he has seen in these books and what it might mean. Let me get you to pin you down on something, because I don't know that I got it quite. Of the 70 books, how many of them are open, and how many of them have you read cover to cover?
I've looked at quite a few of them, and for forensic purposes, we did open some of them because we needed to test the dust and detritus under laboratory conditions to check for pollen and to see if it was consistent with a first century date. But there are quite a few that are still closed and need to be opened under laboratory conditions.
Would you say half?
I'd say half, yeah. Yeah, for
but
sure.
Half are unopened, half are already opened.
Yeah,
and of the ones that you've opened, have you read all of the ones that are opened cover to cover?
I have indeed. And there is some very significant information on there, which, again, a lot of it in code, though, which we've got to work on over the next few months or so. I'm hoping that the code will not take too long to decipher, although there does seem to be a link with some of the Dead Sea Scrolls on this. And so I think it may well be a very, very swift process.
When you say a link to the Dead Sea Scrolls, what do you mean by that?
The same decipherment in terms of codifying the language is to be seen present within the scrolls, and we've noticed the same delineation of letters and placement of different syllables, etc. So it seems to me that the code is probably already known through Dead Sea Scrolls scholarship. So once we get to grips with that, I suspect that we'll be opening up hordes of information about the origins of Christianity and what may well be the true and real secrets about the temple when Jesus went into it.
That is tantalizing. Would you be willing to come back?
I would love to. That would be fantastic.
Good. Now, do any of these books contain any new biographical information about Jesus that you're willing to talk about?
We've come across a few bits, but I'm not at liberty to talk about that at present.
Okay.
We'll be discussing some of that in a few weeks' time.
Okay, and that's important only because, as we know, there's some missing years there, the 13 to 30 period, where not a lot is known, and there's been much speculation about his involvement with Essenes or with other groups or traveling to the east, to the Orient, so that part will be interesting to see what is confirmed or disconfirmed the release of this information.
The other Dark Age period of Christianity, of course, is the period between his crucifixion and the letters of St. Paul, because we have no documentation from that period until now. And that's going to be very interesting, too.
Hmm.
So, these may well open up all sorts of points about that as well.
Well, of course, in the other piece, if you mentioned the letters of St. Paul in the New Testament, is that we have half of the conversations with St. Paul, where the references are made to other letters, and that he responds to things that are written by the James camp in Jerusalem, but we don't have those letters. We just have Paul's letters. So,
yeah, and I suspect our books may reveal quite a bit about that, because one of our suspicions is that these books were actually created by the direct followers of Jesus and his family, a sect called the Ebionites, whose name in Hebrew translates as the poor, which would certainly explain Jesus' rather mysterious saying in the Gospels, "Blessed are the poor in spirit."
Okay. Well, let's hold on to that, and we'll start taking your questions. We'll get a half hour of calls in, so make them count, for David Elkington, and then we'll do open lines in the last hour. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Ponet. And let's get to your calls for David Elkington, author, scholar, biblical scholar, artist, and the man who is one of the few who has held in his hands one of these new 70 metal codices, which have been so far proven to be about 2,000 years old, and writing of the events in Christian history in the first century, in the first half of the first century, and only recently being revealed to the world. You can talk to him, and then we'll do open lines next hour. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. Well, we got a lot of calls here, so let's just ask if the questions get to a concise point as quickly as possible. For David Elkington, we'll start with Tyrone west of the Rockies in Compton, California, on Coast to Coast. Tyrone?
Yeah, how you doing, Ian?
Great, go ahead.
Yeah. Hey, you know, guys, I'm thinking about moving to the Middle East and opening up a deli. We call it Jesus of Nazareth.
Okay, thanks, Tyrone. Let's go to, I know your life was building up to that, but hey, Corrine is in Greensboro, North Carolina, east of the Rockies on Coast to Coast for David Elkington. Corrine?
Yes, hi.
Hi, go ahead.
David, I've listened to your reasoning regarding why you believe the codices are authentic, and I certainly don't doubt your expertise. I'm not an expert, but I'm bothered about something. With everything that's going on in the world religious-wise now, Muslim and Christian tension and tension in Israel and all the 2012 hype, the timing of this discovery seems contrived to me. I think back to what's been said about Project Bluebeam and how part of Bluebeam prior to the holographic beams themselves actually being used to project messiahs into the sky, that what was supposed to have been planned to be done is that fake religious relics would be discovered in expected places all over the world, but particularly in Israel and the Arab world. And I know that people want to believe, and I wondered if you had considered any tie-in between all of this this timing with what's going on in the world, the having had these books just handed over.
All right, David, do you see significance in that?
You know, it's a difficult thing to consider all the options in that sense. I mean, the whole thing is, my wife and I have, with all humility, have actually approached this in a way that we can say is rational and logical. We've undertaken analysis at significant expense to ourselves, and we've actually made sure that we've done everything in a fit and proper fashion. And the metal has been tested. It has been shown to be consistent with a 2,000-year-old age. We've looked at the language side of things, which we've just discussed. Would forgers, whoever they are, be able to forge something that looks so entirely convincing? I mean, I do take your point that the timing is very curious, but at the same time, you've got to say to yourself that if there is a plan, then perhaps some good things are meant to be discovered, and perhaps this is one of them.
Yep. Well, and let's make the point, though, too. There is nothing new about fake biblical artifacts. There is nothing new about that. So when she says, you know, at a significant time in history, these will appear, they've always been there. And both scholars and universities have gotten burned over and over again on things that they were sold as being authentic and of the biblical era and turned out to be.
You are absolutely right. I mean, that is exactly it. That's why we've been so very, very careful to make sure that we made sure that we got to a certain point in the project before we brought on the academic team. And I've spoken at great length with Dr. Margaret Barker and Professor Philip Davies, one of the world's leading Dead Sea Scroll scholars. And we've consulted at huge length to show that, you know, these things are what they are. And we have here the very greatest team of scholarship looking at these things. And all of us are now convinced that these are not forgeries. If the experts are saying that, and we've got the evidence, then finally I think we can say, yes, we can go for it. But you are absolutely right. There are so many fakes and forgeries out there. I'm an Egyptologist by profession, and when I go to Egypt, I can buy fakes left, right, and center, and they are very, very good. But
right.
The question you've got to ask yourself from the outset is, why on earth would the Bedouin have forged something so entirely unique?
Yeah. It was something which seemingly might be actually unmarketable.
Exactly. That's precisely the point. Right. They always do forgeries of things. Now, let's say that these are forgeries. Then you've got to say to yourself, what are they forgeries of and where are they?
Let's go to Randy, first time caller line in Lake Forest, California, on Coast to Coast for David Elkington.
Hi, David. Hi, Ian. It's a pleasure to be on the show tonight. I just wanted to ask you if you had considered the similarities with the Book of Mormon and the account of Lehi and his family bringing brass plates that contain the genealogy of their family history and bringing that with them about 700 BC to the Americas. And then the Book of Mormon itself being a compilation of the writings of the peoples that lived in the Americas since then, and the golden plates, which Joseph Smith brought out of the Mount Cumorah in New York, and the similarities. Can you comment on that?
Which have never, unfortunately, also never been found, right? I mean, that's part of the
right.
problem of the plates is they are legendary because no one's ever been able to examine them.
Other than the account of the three witnesses that
right.
is in the Book of Mormon, which,
right.
you know.
Right, but I mean, again, here you have a physical, in the case here, the copper books. But go ahead, David, have you thought about that connection?
We have, actually, and I have to say thank you to our Mormon friends in America. They have been extremely helpful in the process of helping in the repatriation. I spoke this week to a leading Mormon scholar who is an excellent scholar and a man who is doing his very best to help the process of repatriation of the codices back to Jordan. And indeed, I can see the significance here. There is an awful lot that's got to be taken seriously from the Book of Mormon in terms of the pursuit of understanding of these texts. And obviously, it's very early days yet, but I'm very, very much looking forward to working with Mormon scholars on a further understanding of these issues.
Yeah, well, there's somebody who's got $10 million. Let's go to Sharon in Portland, Oregon, on Coast to Coast on a wild card line for David Elkington. Sharon?
Hello, and thank you. I'm very interested in this, and I have a follow-up to that question previous. Have you had contact with Daniel Peterson of BYU and the Mormon Ancient History Scholars?
Hi, Sharon. It's great to speak with you. No, I haven't at the present time. I'm speaking with another scholar who is quite often in the Middle East and deals with things specifically with this. But if he wishes to get in touch, then he would be very welcome to do so.
Yes, he's very well known. You mentioned a quote from Matthew, I believe it is part of the Beatitudes. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for
yep.
there is the kingdom of heaven. I wondered
yep.
if you were aware of the translation that Joseph Smith did of the New Testament, where he basically went through and made corrections and he interpreted that as, blessed are the poor in spirit who come unto me, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And he clarified that particular one, and I didn't know
okay.
if something.
All right.
That's
Thank
a
you,
very
Sharon.
Beautiful saying, isn't it? I mean, that really is terribly, terribly beautiful. You've got to admire the man who uttered those words. He must have been very special. And I think that, you know, what we have here in terms of the plates, lead is a very poor metal in terms of, you know, there was a lot of it. It was very cheap. And we know the first Christians were not a small movement. They were actually a considerable movement in terms of size. And they would have been able to have afforded to buy lead and to create these plates, perhaps. And it strikes me that being a poor metal, that the followers of Christ, the Ebionim or the Ebionites, the poor, would be just the people to have created these things and to have written down upon them the mysteries of the temple. So I think that does go some way to explaining Jesus' great statement. And I look forward to investigating further.
Brent is in Riverside, California, on a wild card line for David Elkington, the man who has seen the codices, which we've linked up on our webpage at coasttocoastam.com. You can see it under tonight's guest. Go ahead, Brent.
Good morning, gentlemen. The little book, the sealed book, when it's introduced in Revelation, John eats it, and it's sweet in his mouth and then bitter in his stomach. I was wondering if you thought there may be a tie-in with that, with how lead was used to sweeten wine during the first century.
Yeah, it's funny. I discussed that in my forthcoming book, strangely enough. Lead was used by the Romans in terms of cooking pots. They would boil down grape juice to use it as a kind of a flavoring for other foods. And the Emperor Claudius, in one of the great Roman classics of Tacitus, talks about his groaning stomach pains, which, of course, is consistent with lead poisoning. And I think that when St. John actually complains about the bitter taste and the bitter, you know, aspect of it in his stomach, again, you've got the idea here of lead poisoning. So it's a very good point. I've got to tell you, the Bedouin in whose ownership these are, he's quite a character. He's quite volatile and quite wild. And I've often wondered if he himself is suffering from lead poisoning, because he likes to handle these things very, very regularly. And there are specific signs of it there in his wild nature.
In the Israeli Bedouin, not the Jordanian Bedouin.
The Israeli Bedouin, that's right, yes.
What do we know about the Jordanian Bedouin who supposedly is the one that sold it to the Israeli Bedouin?
Not very much, but the details we have had, we've been dealing with our friends the Jordanians to try and elicit more information, and we're just trying to sort of work in a slowly, softly way to just cooperate with the people there and to just understand more about the circumstance of the find and where it is. And the area is full of shepherds, and all of them are ex-soldiers. And, you know, these are they're lovely people. I've got to be honest with you. A lot of them are good friends. And we're finding out quite a bit, and we'll know more in the ensuing months.
Well, I have you on the subject, and then we'll get back to more calls, I promise, here in just a second. Can you clear up the point then? The Israeli Bedouin in the article that I read said, no, he didn't get it from this Jordanian guy. He's had it in his family for three generations. For 100 years or so, these metal books have been in his family. Is this the lead poisoning talking here? Is this the...
Yeah. Well, I've got a smile at that, Ian. I mean, the classic British statement on that is, he would say that, wouldn't he? Yeah. I must tell you one thing. When we took the scrapings from the original lead book to test it at the laboratory asked for... they offer a statement on where the metal came from, and the Israeli Bedouin admitted that it came from Jordan. And in fact, the opposition had an article in the London Jewish Chronicle on the 3rd of March this year, in which they too had to admit that it came from Jordan. And all of the signs are there. There's a lot of evidence that they came from Jordan, and very recently too. So I'm afraid to say that the idea of them being in his family for over 100 years is very amusing, because they would have emerged by now.
Wade is in Canada on Coast to Coast for David Elkington. Wade?
Hi, gentlemen. I have a small question. You're talking about seven books and 70 books. Does that mean there are 10 leaves in each book, or does it mean something else?
There are up to 70 books. The books themselves can comprise anything of three or four leaves, right up to 15 or even 20 leaves. They are very, very beautiful to look at. Some of them are very, very profound indeed. And there is a broad mixture in the collection. The circumstance in which they were found in the cave in Jordan is also very interesting, too, because they were found in niches. Each niche contained a book. And then not far away in this quite enormous cave, there were other boxes containing further books. So... There might be a separation in terms of the hoard, in terms of what was important and what was any secondary in importance.
Bill is in Oregon, our second to last caller for David Elkington, but he's promised to come back on when more of the details of the content of these books can be revealed. Bill?
Yeah, my question has to do with the Dead Sea Scrolls. I'm interested in what has not been publicly revealed, and does your guest have anything he hasn't said already that he wants to say?
Oh, well, Well, I'll just say, I think all of the Dead Sea Scrolls, according to all the scholars we've had on the air, all of them, all of the information is available that can be revealed in that there are fragments that they've yet to piece together. There's literally like hundreds of thousands of little pieces of fragments that they haven't been able to sort out. But of the things that can be, the texts, it's been open to scholars for quite some time. Okay, so I guess the question is there something else that you want to reveal that you haven't revealed yet?
Not really, because the problem is with everything. You know, archaeology is a science, but it begins as an inexact science before becoming very precise. And as ever, it's always a matter of interpretation, and one has to be very, very careful there. And my point on this is that the reason we have a slow release of information is that we're trying to put ourselves back into the mind of ancient humanity 2,000 years ago and what they thought about these things. And to do that, we've got to strip all Western sympathies and influences away from our minds, if it's at all possible, in order to try and get to that point. Because it's very easy with our information technology, our TV and our telephones, etc., to get the wrong impression. And that's something that has tainted biblical studies for many, many years. We have to be really very, very careful to be sympathetic to the writings and their time.
Now, a process that's called exegetical, for letting the book speak for itself, from as opposed to imposing on it what we wanted to say. We'll get our last caller from Cleveland. Mike is on a Skype line on Coast to Coast, and then we'll go to open lines next hour. Hey, Mike.
Hey, how you guys doing? My question is about the phonetic part of the text, and what type of decoding strategies have you used? This Paleolithic Hebrew, I guess it's still 21 phonetic characters?
Yeah, we believe so. It's early stages yet. We've made a couple of breakthroughs, but we haven't been concentrating much on the decoding because we've been looking at other historical aspects to do with the codices. So we're kind of slowly approaching the decoding process, and hopefully over the next few months or so, we'll be working with the international team to approach an answer to the decipherment, and hopefully we'll have more news on that.
Yeah, that's very cool, because I've been having some luck. I'm from GenesisKey.org, and with a 7-1 right and a 7-11 left, simple rotate left, I found a lot of hidden information in some run length codes, and I just was wondering with this Hasmonean if you guys have tried something with 7-1 left and 7-11 right, just throwing it out there.
Thank you very much. That could be very useful, and if I certainly find that, I'll announce it and give my thanks to you.
Well, there you go. See, now that's why you have to come back on this show.
That's great.
You get the full gamut of that type of exact, strong, good suggestion, you know, at the end of a half hour that starts with, you know, cheeses of Nazareth. So there you go. You get it all here, David. We look forward to that. Thank you. Continue to do your work there, and to do it judiciously, and as we say in scholarship, open for correction. And I know you'll do it well. And I know that as this information comes out, that it's gonna create a lot of conversations. And we hope that some of them will be here on Coast to Coast. So thank you.
Thank you, Ian. And may we say God bless your audience. And we look forward to being back on your show very soon, and hopefully being over in America very soon to talk about this face-to-face and to meet everybody.
Good. Well, I promise you let me know where you will be, and I'll be there too. God bless you. And let's go to open lines coming up for our last hour. Any topic you want, Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.